I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 19th, and we have a lot to talk about. And I guess I could begin today's episode by saying, welcome to the next normal. With the exception of public transportation, mask mandates have pretty much ended, and bars, restaurants, concerts, music festivals, public buildings, and other businesses no longer require proof of vaccination. It looks like the COVID-19 pandemic is over, except for the fact that we're seeing cases of the latest COVID subvariant continue to rise in cities across the country and around the world. So how do we navigate this new world? And if you happen to be immunocompromised, how do you stay safe? Joining me as she has throughout the pandemic with an update, including the steps you can take to stay safe as the world reopens, is Dr. Nancy Sicott. Dr. Sicott is a professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Dr. Sicott also chairs the National MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee, and she leads the MS Society's COVID-19 Advisory Group. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Nancy Sicott, there are a few other things that you should know about. Stem cell therapy is a hot topic throughout the Real Talk MS listener community, as well as the greater MS community. We talk about it often on the podcast because there's what seems to be a steady stream of clinical evidence supporting the use of some stem cell therapies in treating MS. And we also talk about stem cell therapy because there's so much information about it that's posted on social media sites. And like most everything else posted on social media, some of that information is helpful and accurate, and a lot of it isn't. So I wanted to share some news with you about a focused workshop that took place last month. And the topic of the workshop was autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT. This workshop was organized by the European Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis, and it brought together a group of global experts who reviewed the evidence, arrived at a consensus, and published a report reflecting the presentations made and some of the conclusions reached at the workshop. The report acknowledges that an increasing body of clinical evidence supports AHSCT as a highly effective treatment for MS. The report further points out that in specific cases, AHSCT could be considered a more effective treatment option than disease-modifying therapies. And the report acknowledged that leading MS organizations have updated their guidelines to reflect this new evidence-based understanding of AHSCT and are now recommending AHSCT as a therapeutic option in selected patients with MS, which, by the way, is exactly what the National MS Society did in October of 2020. We talked about those new recommendations when they were originally announced, but in case you missed it or need a refresher, here's a quick review. The National MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee advised that the best candidates for AHSCT are people who are less than 50 years old, who have had relapsing MS for 10 years or less, and they've experienced new disease activity despite treatment with a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy. The MS Society's guidance also points out that people should receive this treatment from teams experienced in both AHSCT and MS, and at centers that are certified by the Foundation for the Accreditation of Cellular Therapies in the U.S. or the European Society for Blood and Marrow Transplantation in Europe. And the MS Society pointed out the need for further research to identify best practices in the procedure itself, and clinical trials to compare the efficacy of AHSCT to the best available disease-modifying therapy. And by the way, those clinical trials are currently underway. Scientists are learning more about hematopoietic stem cell transplantation every day. Just like disease-modifying therapies, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. So far, it's been shown to be effective for individuals who match up with the very specific patient profile that's described in the MS Society's guidance. But the work is ongoing. We're hearing encouraging news about another stem cell therapy using mesenchymal stem cells, so there's lots more for us to talk about. And more attention being paid to stem cell therapy as a result of the work done by the experts who participated in the workshop that was organized by the European Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis. If you'd like to learn more about the workshop and review the details of all the presentations that were made, you'll find a link in today's show notes. And I'll also include a link to the National MS Society's detailed guidance for autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. The FDA has approved a Phase 1b, Phase 2a clinical trial designed to study an investigational myelin-restoring treatment for people with relapsing remitting MS. Recruiting for the trial begins later this year, and it's going to involve 45 people with relapsing remitting MS, some of whom will receive treatment with PIPE-307, an investigational oral therapy from the biotech company Pipeline Therapeutics, while others in the group will receive a placebo. Now, this trial is primarily designed to evaluate the safety and tolerability of this treatment, although measurements of myelination will also be taken and assessed. A previous Phase 1 trial of PIPE-307 used a type of imaging called positron emission tomography, or PET, to show that the PIPE-307 therapy actually made its way to the brain in 6 healthy adult study participants at levels that were associated with remyelination in animal models. And whether this particular therapy proves to be effective or not, this study is just one example of science knocking on the door of remyelination. And remember, remyelination means restoring lost function. We'll keep you posted on this study and other studies that are or soon will be taking place, all of which will advance our understanding of restoring myelin and restoring function that's been lost to MS. A couple of weeks ago, at the American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, Dr. Christopher Orlando presented evidence from several studies conducted in the U.S. that show greater MS disease severity and a higher disability burden among Hispanic and Black people who are living with MS. During his presentation, Dr. Orlando went on to explain that race and ethnicity themselves don't really account for this. Instead, he shared neighborhood-level evidence that points to a set of interrelated social causes, like access to resources, environmental exposures, and psychosocial stress that are probably more at the root cause of these well-documented health disparities. The neighborhood-level evidence that Dr. Orlando shared was a result of a new first-of-its-kind study in the United States, and it showed that while the clinical factors of more severe MS were similar among Hispanic people, Black people, and white people, large differences were apparent when the social determinants of health were concerned. For instance, the study results showed that Hispanic people who were living with MS were less likely to speak English as a first language, and they were less likely to have completed 12 years of education. Study results also showed that Black people who were living with MS were less likely to live in a rural county and more likely to be unemployed. Now, if there's good news here, it's that the study did not show any sort of biologic or genetic factors that influence the severity of MS among members of these minority populations. But the data certainly demonstrate the impact that social determinants of health can have on people who are living with a chronic illness like multiple sclerosis. Pointing out systemic inequities and disparities in quality of life is a clear indication that there's much more work to be done here. And while refining the healthcare system and creating real diversity in clinical research may be very heavy lifts. This work is absolutely vital if we're going to reach a point where everyone living with MS has access to quality care and effective treatments. And to that end, I want to tell you about the National African Americans with MS Registry. This patient registry was developed by a group of MS specialists, including leading African American MS neurologists, and its goal is to develop an accurate understanding of the number of African Americans living with MS, their potential barriers to care, and whether certain medications are of more benefit to African Americans with MS. If you're an African American who's living with MS, your participation in this registry is invited. Once you register, you'll be asked to complete a series of surveys so that researchers can learn about you, your disease, and the medicines or other medical services that you use to help manage your MS. Your participation is voluntary, and there's no payment for participating. You aren't required to answer every survey question, and you can choose to stop participating anytime. The information you provide will be used anonymously by researchers to, for example, compare the rate of MS between different geographic regions, or to compare the healthcare available to Black people living with MS in rural areas versus urban areas. Your personal identity won't be contained in any report, nor will it be shared with insurance companies or any other company. If you'd like to register or learn more about the National African Americans with MS Registry, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Data shows that people in minority communities have been hit especially hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. Case counts, hospitalizations, and COVID-related deaths have all been disproportionately high in these underserved communities. But now we're seeing hospitalizations and deaths decline across the board. With the exception of public transportation, mask mandates have ended, and businesses have stopped requiring proof of vaccination in order for you to enter. But if you're living with MS, and if you're immunocompromised, you have to be wondering, what does that mean for you? How do you re-enter this next normal? I think we all have a lot of questions. And in a moment, my guest, Dr. Nancy Sicott, will join us to share some answers. COVID-19 has impacted the way we work, the way we go to school, the way we socialize with friends and family. It's truly changed the way we live. And many of us are wondering about what may come next. Joining us today to talk about where we are in the COVID-19 pandemic and what the future may hold for people living with MS is a friend of this podcast, Dr. Nancy Sicott. Dr. Sicott is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. Dr. Sicott also chairs the National MS Society's National Medical Advisory Committee and leads the MS Society's COVID-19 Advisory Group. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Sicott.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
For the past 2 years, COVID-19 has upended what most people would call the normalcy of daily life. Experts seem to agree this virus isn't going away anytime soon, but there's hope that the COVID-19 vaccines and new treatment options can move us from pandemic to endemic. So to get us started, I hope you'll explain the difference between a pandemic and endemic.
Well, thank you, John. Yeah, I think we're all struggling to see what the future is going to look like and how we're going to cope with it. And I guess the theme has been, it's never what we expected. And so we have to remain resilient and flexible. But when this all started, when they declared the pandemic, that means that the whole world is experiencing infection with some sort of infectious agent. And it's involving the whole world. And we've been living with that for the last 2 years. gradually and eventually a pandemic will either disappear, which would we were all hoping for, or instead turn into sort of a low level but continuous areas where the infection is evident. So you'll see pockets of infection that will sort of flare up at different locations. So we're kind of transitioning into endemic, but we still really are living in a pandemic because if we look around the world, we see many, many countries where the virus is still very, very active. But what we are hoping to move toward is a time when the virus will be something that we can live with and that we can manage somewhat the same way as we manage the flu, for example. So we know it's coming every year and it causes illness and sometimes death. But we can get on with our lives and have ways to mitigate and treat it. And we just have to accommodate to it. I think that's the stage that we're moving toward.
Just weeks after most city and states across the country rolled back their mask mandates and vaccine requirements, COVID-19 case numbers are rising again due to the Omicron subvariant BA2. What do we know about this subvariant so far?
Well, it's very similar to Omicron, but like most of the variants that we've been seeing, it is more contagious. So it's about 10% more easily transmitted than the original Omicron. And the original Omicron was 30 to 40% more transmissible than the Delta that came before it, and so on and so on. So we have been seeing a trend with these variants being more transmissible. But at the same time, I think reassuringly, we are not seeing that they cause more severe disease. So they seem to be less virulent and less likely to end up with people in the hospital or dying. And that may be in part due to the fact that a lot of people have already had an infection with COVID and because of the vaccine. So we have some level of protection. But it does appear that the new variants, especially the Omicron variants, don't cause as severe disease as the others. But it's a very tricky virus, and my friend Avi Nath, who is on Dr. Nath is on our committee. We did a webinar, and this was before the BA2, and he said, "You know, we're going to have more variants. You know, it's coming, and we're going to have more surges." And we said, "Avi, please, you know, we can't." But he was right, and you know, this is just the progress that you see with a virus like this that replicates so rapidly. And with such widespread infection, it's inevitable that we'll see these and we'll continue to see them.
I think I heard recently that a virus's whole biological purpose is to mutate and continue infecting.
Yeah, we think of it as having some consciousness, but it's really selection. It's Darwinian selection, you know, at play. These mutations are totally random. It's a really sloppy organism, especially mRNA. And so it makes mistakes all the time, but it's replicating so much over and over and over again that just by dumb luck, there'll be some version that has some selective advantage. And the selective advantage is, you know, being able to infect people. And if you think about it, they have to be really good at infecting people because so many people have already been infected. So you have to break through that sort of herd immunity that we were kind of hoping for. Again, the plus side is the viruses, if they really did have a consciousness, they don't want to kill everybody off because then that would stop the transmission. So they become better at infecting us, but they mercifully are not killing us all after the infection.
Well, perhaps to that point, at the most recent FDA meeting, there was discussion about the need to broaden the types of vaccines we have available instead of focusing on one variant at a time with a new or updated vaccine. So how would that process work? How long would it take? And I guess the big question is, would broadening our vaccines mean that we'd be protected against all future variants?
Yeah, I think this is important because, you know, we're playing catch up. And so as soon as we test and develop and test a new vaccine, another variant inevitably is going to emerge. So we need to develop one that gets to right to the core of what makes up the coronavirus. And I have read about ways or strategies that people are working toward to develop a universal coronavirus vaccine. Because remember that this is one coronavirus. We could still have another type of coronavirus. It's not SARS-CoV-2 that could emerge and cause another pandemic. And that I don't want to depress people by bringing that up. But because these viruses seem to be the ones that these pandemic potential is highest, there is a lot of interest in creating some kind of vaccine that would really go after sort of the core of what a coronavirus is and neutralize that. And how long that would take, because we have so much transmission of coronavirus, it's shorter than you would think. Some of the vaccines have gone into testing and completed it within months. So I think part of it will be determining what's the best way to have a universal coronavirus vaccine. And that's technology that I'm not expert in, but I know there are people who are working toward that. But I can imagine that we would have an annual vaccine the way we do for the flu. And as you know, those vaccines are made anew every year based on predictions about what types of flu is going to be circulating. So we might see something like that where we have a coronavirus backbone, and then depending on the types of variants that are circulating, we may have additional pieces added onto that each year. They'll be slightly different.
We know that the COVID-19 vaccines that have been approved for use here in the United States are safe for people with MS, and hopefully everyone living with MS has gotten the message that they should be vaccinated. We also know that certain disease-modifying therapies may prevent some individuals from mounting an adequate immune response. Which DMTs are we talking about here, and what does this mean for the people who are taking them?
So thanks for bringing that up, John. We spent a lot of time in our task force looking at the data and presenting advice related to this, because we felt this is really a key question for our population of people living with MS and who are on these drugs. We had a few surprises. One of the drugs, cladribine, we thought was going to cause an issue with the vaccines, and turns out doesn't. But the two other classes where there have been data indicating that the vaccine is not as robust are the B-cell depleters, and that includes Ocrevus and Rituxan and Kesimpta. And then the other are the S1P inhibitors. So that would be Gilenya and Ponesimide, and I always forget the other trade names for them, but they're in that class of medications that cause cells to be sequestered in lymph nodes. So because of the way these drugs work, when you are vaccinated, you don't make as many neutralizing antibodies as you would if you weren't on them. But the other thing to remember is neutralizing antibodies are just one arm of the immune response. And we do have data that, especially with the B-cell depleters, even though you may not be making neutralizing antibodies, you are mounting T-cell responses. And those are really important because that's the second line of defense. Those are the responses that keep you from getting very ill if you do happen to get infected with the virus. So even though these disease-modifying therapies can decrease some of the responses, we still very much recommend that anyone living with MS on these drugs get vaccinated as well.
Someone may be listening and wondering why it's important to still get vaccinated if they're not going to have that immune response.
Yeah, well, as I was saying, what we have seen is even in individuals who may not have a neutralizing antibody response, we can also see that they are protected for the most part from severe disease. So that in and of itself is really the reason why vaccines are developed, to keep people from getting seriously ill. What we know from seeing people who are not on any of these medications, even if you're vaccinated and boosted, you can still get infected with COVID. And we've seen that a lot. And you can get infected more than once. What's important is the vaccine provides protection against severe disease and hospitalization. And that's really the key for what the vaccine is supposed to do. But as you're alluding to, people on these drugs may have a different vaccination schedule because we already know beforehand that they're less likely to have a good, robust response. So the advice now is that you have a total of three vaccines on your initial series in order to boost up that response.
So when we look at the initial series of vaccine and then the boosters, we're looking at a total of 5 doses if someone initially received an mRNA vaccine, that is the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. Is that right?
That is correct. So at this point, individuals who are immunosuppressed would have had a total of 5 shots, 3 from the first series and then the 2 boosters.
I also noticed that the MS Society is now recommending an mRNA vaccine over the J&J vaccine for people who are living with MS. What prompted the change in the guidance there?
So, like a lot of things during this pandemic, John, we are learning as we go, and more data emerged about the J&J vaccine. In particular, there was some slight but increased risk of blood clotting among young women, which is, you know, a lot of the people living with MS. So the J&J vaccine was not a preferred vaccine for our MS population. But then secondly, once the boosters came, it was clear that people who had been vaccinated with J&J who got boosted with the mRNA vaccine had a better response. So they had a more robust response after the mRNA vaccine. So that's been our recommendation going forward.
The COVID-19 vaccines remain the best first defense against becoming infected. But as I've heard you mention, there are medications available to treat COVID-19 and to use before and after exposure to COVID-19. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about what there is available and who might be best suited for those medications.
Well, thank you, John. So I think this is one of the key developments as we move toward this sort of new normal, if you will, and going from pandemic to endemic, where COVID-19 infection becomes a manageable condition. So we have several therapies now that have been shown to decrease the severity of a COVID-19 infection. And even now we have something available to decrease the likelihood of getting infected. So in terms of if you do turn out to have COVID-19, there are several options now that are available. Some of them are infusions, which you get in the hospital, like an antiviral medication called remdesivir, which has been around since the beginning of the pandemic. That's really for hospitalized folks and is now FDA approved. But we do have some exciting oral therapies that can be prescribed as an outpatient. You can go to the pharmacy, get these medications, go home and take them, and hopefully not end up being very sick with COVID. Paxlovid is one of these. This is an oral antiviral. And then another one is molnupiravir, which is also an oral therapy. There was another drug called sotrovimab, which was an IV monoclonal antibody, but it turns out that that doesn't really work very well against the new Omicron variant. So that's now been taken off the market. But the one advance I want to really talk about and remind your listeners about is this new medication called Evusheld. And Evusheld is also a monoclonal antibody, and it's 2 different kinds of monoclonal antibody, and that you take this to prevent an infection with COVID. So it's pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. And what's exciting about this is it's eligible. People are eligible for it if they are immunocompromised and might be at an increased risk for developing severe COVID. So how this works is you would speak with your neurologist. If you are on a B-cell depleter or another medication that decreases your response to the vaccine and you're fully vaccinated, you have to be fully vaccinated to be eligible. You can be referred to get this these injections. So you get 1 injection in each arm, and it gives up to 6 months protection against infection with COVID or certainly developing severe COVID. So up to a 80% reduction, 89% reduction in getting infected with COVID. So think about it as like the antibodies that you don't make because you're immunocompromised. You get those additional antibodies through this intramuscular injection, 1 in each arm. So this, I think, is very important and very exciting for our patients because this can allow people to go out into the world, increasingly a world where people are not wearing masks, and feel a little more comfortable and a little more confident they've got an extra bit of protection as they reemerge.
As you've already alluded to, we're seeing a shift in how people are thinking about COVID-19. It's starting to be considered just a part of everyday life instead of something requiring lockdowns and strict preventive measures. At the same time, some people who are immunocompromised are trying to figure out where they fit into this next normal. Some are feeling like they've kind of been left behind. So how is this shift in the public mindset and in public policy impacting people who are immunocompromised? And perhaps most importantly, how should they be responding in their everyday lives?
Yeah, I think it's a challenge, John. And I think there, that it's a kind of a confidence building steps that people have to take to feel like they can get back out there in the world. And I think, you know, you and I talked about this, how important it is for people living with MS to recognize the trade-offs, that there are consequences for being sequestered and socially isolated. The mental illness crises that we're seeing, the loneliness and the mood issues. People are, humans are social creatures. We are meant to be with other people. And so we have to balance the kind of the risks and the benefits of re-engaging with the world. So there's never, I think it's clear that the virus is still going to be there, but people can take some common sense precautions. You know, keep your mask on, especially when you're indoors and with a lot of other people. Get your vaccines, get boosted, get Evusheld if you're eligible for it. And then, you know, be around people that you know are responsible and that recognize your vulnerability and are sensitive to that. I think most of us, if you really look at it, almost all of us have somebody in our circle that we want to protect against getting sick. I have a new granddaughter. She's not vaccinated and I don't want to give her COVID, you know. So even though I'm not immunocompromised, I'm still very, very careful when I travel or go out and about and I get wear my N95 and so on. So I think, you know, it's just a matter of also the other thing I will say is just knowing more about what's happening around you. So if you're in an area where there's a lot of transmission, you might want to be more careful. Order your groceries in for a week or two. Just have to keep your eye on the ball there.
Well, Dr. Nancy Sicotte, thank you for delivering what I think is a really important and timely update. Thank you for all that you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And once again, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure. Stay well.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/242. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.